Hi folks, welcome to this podcast. It seems an appropriate moment to spend some time understanding our houses and homes. The COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic has grounded many of us inside the walls of our homes. House therapy was created a few years ago by me to help us all comprehend the intimate relationship between house and resident. It seems apparent to me that we can see inside ourselves through looking into the rooms that make up our houses and apartments. Here is the blurb from the house therapy introduction. You do not need to be an architect or an interior designer to benefit from the insights offered by house therapy. Indeed, we are all to some degree designers of our own lives. If not you, who else is the most influential person in your life? And who knows you better? Who else in your life is defining themselves by every decision and choice made as they make their way along their life pathway? Nobody but you, I would proffer. In the following pages and chapters of this book, we will be looking at what houses and homes really are, on a whole host of levels of understanding, documenting examples and explaining their different relevancies. I will be bringing together the bricks and mortar reality of houses with their symbolic meanings to illustrate the core principles underpinning house therapy, like the foundations of a home. We will explore the history of houses and take a guided tour through some of the homes of the most influential cultures and civilizations. We will look at the parallels between the inside of our homes and the inside of our heads. Das ist mein Haus. What is a house or a home really? It is most usually a structure created to protect us from the elements and whatever else life may cast our way. The word house comes from the old English hus, which etymologically is thought to come from the Proto-Germanic word kusan. Our house is a dwelling, a place where we dwell and what we do dwell upon. Do we dwell upon who we are and the things we possess, which may tell us more about who we really are? Do the things inside your home tell you about what you find beautiful and important in the world? Do these things comfort you and provide you with a level of material security about your place in the world? Is your living room an apt reflection of your values and aesthetics today at this juncture in your life? If not, why not? Are you waiting for something, putting off satisfaction for a rainy day, delaying gratification until you truly deserve it, whatever that may or may not be? Are you living your life as if it could be your last day on the planet, or could you be living your life like a poor excuse? Here now is an excerpt from Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, which I feel illustrates how important our surroundings are to us. He woke up late next day after a broken sleep, but his sleep had not refreshed him. He woke up bilious, irritable, ill-tempered, and looked with hatred at his room. It was a tiny cupboard of a room about 6 paces in length. It had a poverty-stricken appearance with its dusty yellow paper peeling off the walls, and it was so low-pitched that a man of more than average height was ill at ease in it and felt every moment that he would knock his head against the ceiling. The furniture was in keeping with the room. There were 3 old chairs, rather rickety, a painted table in the corner on which lay a few manuscripts and books. The dust that lay thick upon them showed that they had been long untouched. A big clumsy sofa occupied the whole of one wall and half the floor space of the room. It was once covered with chintz, but was now in rags and served Raskolnikov as a bed. Often he went to sleep on it, as he was, without undressing, without sheets, wrapped in his old student's overcoat, with his head on one little pillow, under which he heaped up all the linen he had, clean and dirty, by way of a bolster. A little table stood in front of the sofa. Dostoevsky sets the scene, describing in detail the characteristics of the room in which Raskolnikov lives, because it sets the scene for the reader. What is a home? Is it a place where we have accidentally found ourselves over time? Or is it a carefully designed structure which conforms to our every need and want? Perhaps it is something that exists between these two extremes, or not. I imagine that our homes are as unique as we are ourselves, or at least our perception of them is. The home, holder of the hearth, a place you may return to at day's end for rest, replenishment, and relaxation. What would your life be like without a home to go home to? We often hear about the lives of the homeless on the 6 o'clock news. Homeless children who have may have fled domestic abuse or to live on the city streets, and usually these poor, unfortunate people are paraded as examples of extreme social neglect. For the home is considered one of the most basic requirements of life. Indeed, the right to have a home, a place to call your own, no matter how small or poorly maintained, is as important as having enough food to eat. Our home is our refuge and sanctuary from the challenges we may face in the outer world as we bid for survival and success. Your own house may be a building containing many rooms, or it may be a smaller space with fewer rooms. Whatever the size, its layout and furnishings can reflect aspects of ourselves. Our home, the physical structure in which we reside, can be seen as our very own castle, and as such tell a story about our lives. You are the princess or prince, king or queen living inside your castle, and there is a myth or fairy tale taking place right now. Like all good fairy tales, there is a message or archetypal quest happening beneath the daily humdrum. And it is in these rooms within your palace where we can discover it. Each room has a story to tell, and if we can stop for a moment and cast an appraising eye around, we will see it for ourselves. I call this house therapy, but it could also be called Secrets About You Revealed Within Your Home. These seemingly unspeaking rooms within your home do in fact have a voice, as it is in their furnishings, face paint and aspect which tell a story, a compelling story about you and your relationship to the world. It is in how you have or have not influenced the look and feel of every room in your house or apartment. It is in the very isness of your home's appearance that the secret knowledge of who you are and how you relate within it is revealed. Like in so many things, it is based on how we are all connected to everything in our lives, and it is in this holistically connected web that we all survive and occasionally thrive. Our lives leave an impression upon everything we touch, and what greater material impression is left than the one imposed upon our very own home? Every room we walk into, sit in, eat in, and sleep in is affected by our presence, and telltale clues are left for us to piece together if we only know how to look. It is like a form of anthropology or archaeology, this house therapy, and it can reveal our story. We are all familiar with those TV programs detailing the lives of the Egyptian pharaohs who lived thousands of years ago. Well, our own lives can be assessed in the same way. This information is in fact far more valuable to us, as once it is properly analysed, it can change the quality and enjoyment of our living experience. The hieroglyphics on your walls and floors, represented by the arrangement of the furnishings and the interior design of your home, have as much to say about life in the 21st century, and in particular your life, as any statistical study by a sociologist or behavioural psychologist. In fact, the great advantage that house therapy has as a research tool over questionnaires or surveys we may fill in as part of a psychological profile is that it avoids a reliance on our conscious mind putting down what it thinks we should put down, saying the right thing rather than the real thing. Our house or home is the way it is, whether you are a truthful person or not, whether you are a pessimist or an optimist, and whether you are happy or sad. It is the undeniable nature of the imprint that we leave upon our surroundings, which can deliver the most truthful and insightful self-examination you have probably ever received. I guarantee that you will discover things about yourself that you never knew before, and if you take the journey with these insights, well, a richer and more enlightening future awaits you. In this excerpt from Charles Dickens' Hard Times, we find another excellent example of the link between house and owner. A very regular feature on the face of the country, Stone Lodge was, not the least disguised, toned down, or shaded off, that uncompromising fact in the landscape. A great square house, with a heavy portico darkening the principal windows as its master's heavy brows overshadowed his eyes. A calculated, cast-up, balanced, and proved house. 6 windows on this side of the door, 6 on that side. A total of 12 in this wing, a total of 12 in the other wing. 24 carried over to the back wings. A lawn and garden and an infant avenue all ruled straight like a botanical account book. Gas and ventilation, drainage and water service, all of the primmest quality. Iron clamps and girders, fireproof from top to bottom. Mechanical lifts for the housemaids with all their brushes and brooms. Everything that heart could desire. Does your home describe you? Is it a reflection of who you are, of who you and your family are? Take a moment to ponder this question. Take a moment now to imagine looking at your home as a complete stranger would. Begin looking from outside your house or apartment. What do you notice? Grab a pen and paper and take notes. Now step inside your front door and what do you see? On the threshold of your home, what is most obvious to your objective view? According to the principles of house therapy, every room in your house or home represents the domain of a different part of you or a sub-personality of yours. Each room provides an opportunity to observe the interests and concerns of these different parts of ourselves. We are all made up of so many different urges and inclinations, which operate within the framework of our lives and our main controlling identity. We have as adults spent a great deal of time whilst growing up corralling these disparate feelings, thoughts and actions into a recognisable me or you. However, a healthy individual usually knows that this sense of self is at times a tenuous osmotic construct at best, and that all the animals in the zoo need to be fed if you are to sleep easy at night. By which I mean that we are all mostly aware that we have these different perspectives within us, and also that they require specialized treatment by us to fulfill our own sense of completeness. I like that analogy that they are like different animals with their own tastes and mores, and that the whole person is a bit like a zoo containing a variety of environments needed to satisfy each animal. We need to understand what our animals like to eat and feed them appropriately. And house therapy can shine a light on the occupants inhabiting your very own nature park. George Gurdjieff said in London in 1922, "Man is a plural being. When we speak of ourselves ordinarily, we speak of I. We say, I did this, I think this, I want to do this. But this is a mistake. There is no such I, or rather there are hundreds, thousands of little I's in every one of us. We are divided in ourselves, but we cannot recognize the plurality of our being except by observation and study. At one moment, it is one I that acts. At the next moment, it is another I. It is because the I's in ourselves are contradictory that we do not function harmoniously. We live ordinarily with only a very minute part of our functions and our strength, because we do not recognize that we are machines, and we do not know the nature and working of our mechanism. We are machines. We are governed entirely by external circumstances. All our actions follow the line of least resistance to the pressure of outside circumstances. Try for yourself. Can you govern your emotions? No. You may try to suppress them or cast out one emotion by another emotion, but you cannot control it. It controls you. Or you may decide to do something, your intellectual I may make such a decision, but when the time comes to do it, you may find yourself doing just the opposite. Now Gurdjieff, who trained as both priest and physician in Russia, and is remembered as a most remarkable man, can appear to be a mite didactic, but he was hammering on the rock of early 20th century humanity's ignorant conceptions of reality. However, even then he recognized the numerous splinters of self within each individual, and used the machine as a model to describe the inner workings of us human beings. I think that we would all agree that we have a number of interests and expressions of selves within us at any one time. It is the most salient reason why we often cannot make up our minds. When confronted with a situation which has multiple consequences for our many different interests, an example may perhaps be when we are faced with a choice concerning who we will favour when asked to decide on a course of action with limited outcomes, not a win-win situation. Knowing that you must act by your decision, facilitate disappointment or hurt in someone's life is never an easy path to follow, and we often procrastinate in an attempt to delay the inevitable. During these difficult negotiations within ourselves, we come into contact with the various voices within us, as they often represent opinions recommending differing degrees of action to be taken. These voices or subpersonalities may have different qualities and can indeed be aligned with certain behaviours in your life. Your home and the rooms within it are a wonderful way of getting to know these aspects of yourself, and in many cases may provide you with some important information. Daniel Stern, one of the world's foremost early developmental psychiatrists, explains in his research how we as human beings develop different senses of self or perspectives on our world. In the developmental progression of the sense of self, he says, as new behaviours and capacities emerge, they are recognised to form organising subjective perspectives on self and other. The result is the emergence in quantum leaps of different senses of the self. Therefore, we are already at home with multiple perspectives and senses of selves from the earliest possible age, and it is indeed how we process the world and our perception of it. Having several perspectives is a formative experience, and I would suggest that we maintain these different viewpoints throughout our lives and that they operate within a fairly loose, hierarchical structure within us. I like Stern's use of the word domain, meaning home, as he explains how we move various experiences into the houses or areas of responsibility of our newly emergent perspectives or senses of self. The infant is already a mansion of many rooms or domains, and as his or her universe continues to expand, so too will the number of rooms within us. We are housing our different voices within their own areas of influence and creating ourselves as multiverses, a hive of chambers under the auspices of a queen bee. So, to review what we have covered so far in house therapy, I have introduced you to the concept of the house symbolically representing our own inner universes, and that its layout may offer some clues as to how we think. This is the idea of the working model or paradigm, and what the house can offer through this particular perspective. We have also begun to look at what a house or home may actually mean to us on so many levels. Seeing the home as an outer manifestation of our requirements for security, emotional succor, and keeping all those big bad wolves from our door. Further, I have touched upon the importance of houses as structures in history that have housed gods and are divine places of holy worship. The powerful idea that we as humanity have brought God down from the sky and housed him or her in a home of bricks and mortar. In addition to this, we have considered the possibility that we are constructed, psychologically speaking, from multiple perspectives from the earliest of ages. That this multiplicity of selves or voices is integral to how we have developed and operate. Also, we have seen examples of the ongoing existence of these subpersonalities in a variety of forms and referenced in literature. This, however, is only the beginning, and now let us bring the focus back to you and your house or home. The living room, the dominant you, and the emperor's grand hall. So, let us begin from the outer and most obvious identity, Let us now enter your living room or the main room of your house, as this is most likely your dominant persona, the you spend the most time being or inhabiting. This is the you that you most walk and talk in, the you that you can relax into and still function around family, friends, and whoever you choose to invite into your living room. This room is where the most recognizable you resides most often, and represents the personality construct which can shift between public and private consciousness, the you which holds the middle ground, so to speak, and who can vacillate without too much stress between the two worlds of inner and outer you. This is often a more commendable balancing act than is often given credit for. I suppose in some ways it is the definition of functioning sanity, for we must be able to delve into our inner universe, which has far fewer limitations imposed upon it, and then flip back into the more strictly ordered two-dimensional universe we call shared reality, inside the living room of our life. Have a look around your living room right now. Is it a tidy, well-ordered space, or a comfortably lived-in, dare I say, messy space? Here are the first clues about ourselves. These are the bones arranged on the cave floor from which to cast a first look at ourselves. It is telling us how we keep our various selves together. Are we loose within our dominant personality construct, or are we tight, possibly uptight, within our sense of self? Do you value order within your universe and having a place for everything you possess and keeping those things in their place? Conversely, do you allow things to fall and be where they may and disown any responsibility for the pattern of their existence? Two decidedly different approaches to living and interacting with the material plane. Starting with the clean and tidy space, what is cleanliness and order really all about? I think it is ultimately about identity, that the being concerned with orderliness is concerned with the outer arrangement of its life corresponding with the inner, that there is a symmetry between the inner and the outer, as above, so below, that any outer manifestation is in direct correlation to the organizing principles held within, that the furniture and utensils within the home of the tidy occupant are neatly arranged and ordered in similar fashion to show how they categorize and file their thoughts and values inside their own minds, that the external sense of placement has a symbiotic relationship with their inner universe, that every thought and feeling has a place within the construct of self, and that there is a room where this part of the self is king or queen, and therefore everything on the material plane needs to likewise have a home or place to live and be. Naming things can be a great example of this. Filing systems, boxes with name tags, alphabetical categorization of CDs or books, and those gadgets that stick on name tags are all illustrations of the need for order. We all desire order of some description in our lives. We all have drawers where certain objects are stored so as to be found again. It is merely the degree of order in our lives that we are considering right now. I have found that it is often at times of stress within people's lives when challenges to that internal order are being made, perhaps through relationships or work relationship difficulties or changes, when an individual's identity is being stretched by circumstances, that this concern with our outer order is particularly highlighted. If you pay attention to your inclinations to tidiness, and when you are getting upset about mess and disorder, it can be an opportunity to ask yourself what is really going on. Why am I now particularly so affected by disorder? I would ask you now to ponder your sense of identity and to see what comes up for you in the spirit of contemplation. Identity. When you first ask yourself, who am I? What is your initial answer? Grab a pen and paper or keyboard and begin the process. Put down your first answer and then keep asking the question, who am I? Get down as many answers as come to mind. Is your idea of who you are a set one, and does it have clear parameters around it? Was your identity shaped by your parents and your upbringing? Who am I? Has it been influenced by events in your life, by things that have happened to you, and perhaps also by things that have not happened for you? Do you consider that your identity is pretty much established now, or is it still very much a work in progress? As you may begin to see, the eternal question, who am I, has within it an almost bottomless well of answers and replies. Layers of self and relationships are revealed, identities peel away like bark upon a paper bark tree. Mother, wife, husband, father, daughter, son, teacher, student, lover, fighter, lawyer, shopkeeper, butcher, baker, IT professional, good man, good woman, human being, mammal, carbon life form, point of consciousness, and the list goes on. We are so many things and have so many masks of identity which we wear at different times. Who we are, how we talk, and what we walk in are, I think, evolving concepts, affected by the stages of our lives. Childhood, adolescence, adulthood, marriage, parenthood, middle age, retirement, old age. Within these more clearly defined categories are others, like the kind of work we do or career. And this again affects our sense of who we are, like a layer of identity we wear, similar to a uniform, whether we are a nurse or a policeman or not. We may not have an actual uniform, but our behaviour may mirror one. As a male, it is still very usual to be asked when in company, what do you do for a living, as the stereotypical but very outdated hunter providers we are supposed to be. Gather in groups at parties and greet each other with these exploratory questions about how we provide for our dependents within the tribe. Our identity then has layers like an onion, and tears can be generated when peeling back those layers, when life asks us to reveal our softer underbelly. Social chit-chat and small talk almost requires us to create an outer layer made up of generalizations based on gender, age, occupation, and perhaps wealth or status, depending on where this social interaction may be taking place. For many people, the creation of this outer persona can remove them from a keener sense of their self, from operating out of a perspective which is closer to their heartfelt values. Living your life predominantly inside a persona such as this can be a way of hiding for those who are unsure of their acceptance within their community. Very often, it is actually a lack of self-acceptance which underlies behaviours such as these. Our intimate identity, our sense of being more closely linked to what we truly value and feel, is more often shared with those nearest and dearest to us. In many cases, we need to feel a certain security in the behaviours of those closest to us before we will reveal our true natures. So our identities are clearly made up of various degrees of manifestation of who we are. Like a glimpse of a bird's wing not fully unfurled may appear to be a mere ruffle of feathers. What is our life? What is our life? A play of passion, our mirth, the music of diversion. Our mother's womb, the tiring houses be, where we are dressed for this short comedy. Heaven, the judicious sharp spectator is, that sits and marks, still who doth act amiss. Our graves that hide us from the searching sun are like drawn curtains when the play is done. This march we playing to our latest rest, only we die in earnest, that's no jest. A poem by Sir Walter Raleigh. It has been said that Raleigh wrote this verse shortly before he was executed. I think this poem beautifully illustrates the self-awareness that the author exhibits in his analysis of the nature of existence and the short cycle of human life. It draws particular poignancy from Raleigh's impending death and the wheel of life and its extremities of triumphs and the final fall from grace. His home for many years whilst awaiting his bloody demise was the Tower of London. His status as a knight and gentleman assured his comfort even during his imprisonment, which shows that even if your home is a prison, it could still be a home with all the concerns and personalization that entails. Let's get practical now and answer these questions. Is your living room a large or small room? This can indicate whether you have an overriding concept of who you are or to whether you see yourself as one of many billions upon this planet. Are you more inclined to be totally focused on yourself, or do you prefer the idea that you are just another fish in the pond? Our relationship to the space we live in literally defines who we are and how we appear to the world outside us. In this model representing who we are, what does your living room tell you about yourself? First impressions are often the most valuable, and this can be seen by the fact that it is often right at the beginning of a relationship that we know who our friends and lovers really are, and that the fundamental orientation is shown from the start. Who are you? What does your relationship to the physical space around you tell you about yourself? If you were to get down on your living room floor right now, lie down and close your eyes, take a few relaxing breaths, what would your sense of self be like? Do you consider yourself, your consciousness, to be a big entity or not? Is it spatial at all for you? Does your sense of who you are have mass? Meditation, that inner space within yourself, when we close our eyes and detach from the physical elements around us. What does this tell you about you when you close your eyes and meditate? If you don't usually meditate, just close your eyes and have a go, nothing ventured, nothing gained. What pulses inside you? Try it now. Close your eyes and just be. Be in the nothingness. Be in the darkness or the blankness, whatever it is for you. Sense within who you are and feel that awareness, that witness state, like running your tongue along your teeth inside your mouth and feeling something new and strange for the first time. You are infinitely sensitive to its foreignness. Is your consciousness big or small? Is it finite or is it infinite? Who are you? What are you? Take a deep breath and now let it go. Slowly come back and return to your living room. Open your eyes and have a look around your living room once more. Does your living room have lots of things in it, like furniture and rugs, books and knickknacks, or is it more zen-like and an uncluttered area? Look afresh at your living space and see what is actually there. Is your dominant self like a magnanimous ruler who allows the many sub-personalities to convey their existence through a collection of evidence displayed throughout the room? Or conversely, are you an emperor who wishes no trace of tribal affiliations to be publicly revealed? The seamless appearance or non-appearance of identity on show, or at least the visage of a unified nothing muchness, can provide clues to the strategies employed by this main self. Do you wear your heart on your sleeve, or are you a person who prefers to present a more neutral look to the world? Do you value your tastes and interests enough to put them on show? A number of things can be indicated here. You may be someone who prefers to keep their likes and dislikes to themselves, or at least to limit access to these revelations to a more intimate circle, perhaps your life partner and nobody else. This means that you will not have personal effects and displays of your artistic tastes on show in your living room. Another possibility is that you may feel slightly unsure about your own aesthetic sensibilities, especially when you are sharing your house with others, and this can indicate that you have not totally accepted yourself for who you are. It may be telling you that you are still looking for someone's ultimate approval, and it is interesting to stop and ask yourself whose approval you are wanting. Oftentimes, the answer can appear in the form of a Russian doll, with truths within truths. For example, you may become aware that you are seeking the approval of your partner. And if you dig a little deeper, this may reveal the fact that you are seeking the approval of a parent and so on, until you realize that it is in fact a part of yourself, perhaps your censorious, controlling self, who is questioning your public display of what you find beautiful, appropriate to display in your home. This perspective is often not offering a definitive standard of what is aesthetically pleasing, but merely criticizing and doubting your initial impulse. If you find similar dynamics occurring within yourself, I recommend taking the time to engage in some internal dialogue, reassuring this part of yourself that it is okay to take a bit of a risk and put something up on the wall or on display, that it is perfectly acceptable to try and see if something looks good there. If the things in your living room are not there for your pleasure, but for somebody else's, then why are you living there? It should be their living room, not yours. If they are already living there and they are your partner and you are sharing the space, make sure that you are sharing the space and not sacrificing your own tastes for theirs. Otherwise, you are living in their identity, not your own. And this, as teenage children will tell you, is not a happy place to be. Taking a break from the living room for a moment, I want to talk about the origin of houses. Humankind lived for many millennia mainly in caves, as these afforded maximum protection from the elements and wild animals. They lit fires in the entrance to their caves, which gave them both warmth and a fiery deterrent to inquisitive predators. Caves were womb-like and mirrored the enveloping security felt inside our mothers, so would resonate deeply within our psyches as places of safety and nurture. This is very important to realize, that our homes are, at their very core, our return to our original places of gestation, our mother's womb. As a species that needs to sleep to physically survive, we require a safe place in which to do so, and our homes in their womb-like function provide this. Be aware of this essential and primal calling within your home, and look to see if your home is providing this at an optimal level. If not, why not? You must be able to feel safe and nurtured within your own home. Failure to do so will cause health problems and psychological unrest. Why did we eventually leave the cave and establish alternate living arrangements? Perhaps climate change was responsible in altering available food sources in nearby geographical locations, and groups of people were then forced to move to new hunting grounds where there were no caves. The advent of agriculture was also quite likely linked to climate change and played its own influential role in establishing communities of dwellings close to their fields and crops. These things were clearly happening in what we now call the Middle East around 10,000 years ago, as archaeological evidence shows. On the Turkish-Iranian border, in a village called Zawi Chinay in Shanidar, the houses had oval or circular stone bases containing hearths and supported a flimsy superstructure of daub and wattle or reeds or matting. But it seems probable that this village was occupied only for half the year, since nearby was the cave of Shanidar, which offered greater protection during the winter months. There was another settlement at Einam in Jordan, and here there were three successive permanent villages, each containing about 50 houses. All were round, up to 7 meters in diameter, and arranged around a central area which contained a large number of plastered bell-shaped pits, probably for food storage. As with the houses at Zawi Chinay, the houses represent the bare essentials of existence, shelter, cooking and warmth, but the details of this construction are worth noting. There was a curious wall 1 meter high from the base, which was built of stone. This presumably was created to make a stiffening frame for a conical roof of reeds. It is interesting architecturally that a plan was made in relief from which a three-dimensional space sprung. It is clear, therefore, that while these builders were still thinking in the flat, a significant stage had been reached, a physical outline had been drawn around privacy. There was a bigger step towards civilized life than may immediately be realized. In the cave, these people lived in a kind of dormitory or doss house. Suddenly, families began to live separately. The reason for this change may have been connected partly with structure, partly with possessions. So far as structure is concerned, they could have been larger, but small dwellings could be managed more easily. Thus, it would seem fairly certain that they exploited the move from cave to gain privacy for their family groups, which is a human and indeed an animal instinct. This development towards a more organized existence also indicates the human need for order. But there is another point, the desire for possessions. These strengthen individual feelings of identity because of the element of cooperation between a person and the things he possesses. This extract is from Stephen Gardner's book The House, The Origins and Evolution. Moving ahead millennia, we see, to quote Stephen Gardner, the advent of the rectangular plan is, of course, tremendously significant. It is the theme which runs through the whole history of the house. And the break from the curved or circular form marks the beginning of a true structural consciousness that is related to simplified building methods. Among all sites for houses and settlements of houses, the rectangle form eventually predominates, but with variations. A continuous strand throughout it is the importance and size of the living room. To begin with, of course, everything living, cooking, sleeping took place in a single space. We spend a lot more time inside of our homes now, as they are much bigger than the early primitive structures, and our transformation of the materials that make up our homes is a millionfold more sophisticated. We have quite literally created palaces for ourselves as homes, and these amazing buildings reflect more of who we are rather than the elements that they might be made of. where we would have taken refuge inside these early homes from wild animals and bad weather, we now live inside our homes as mini universes containing a variety of rooms with varied and different purposes. I would confidently say that many of us spend far more time inside our homes than anywhere else. We generally do not live outside amid the elements much anymore, and have created these wonderful interior worlds with all the available mod cons with which to entertain ourselves. Privacy and individuality have become cornerstones of our existence, and these concepts are clearly reflected in the look and design of our homes. We wish to maintain the walls around our homes, around our individual rooms, and around ourselves and our families. Sharing space is perhaps something we may do at work or school and or at play, but it is not, with the exception of shared housing, which is usually a student, youth, young adult phase, and of which the majority of us rapidly outgrow, a lifestyle we wish to emulate at home. The concept of intimacy within the home is particularly related to our multiple selves and which layer of identity is active in a specific location. We are different people depending upon where we are operating from, and the you who walks and talks in the street and at the market is often very different from the you who lives inside your house. We all usually have aspects of ourselves that we refrain from showing when we are out and about, and we are often more complex and sensitive at home when we are safely ensconced behind our walls, which demarcate our abodes from the street. Imagine for a moment that there were no walls anywhere in your existence and how that would affect you. Would you be less openly sharing of who you really are with friends and family? Or perhaps more revealing of the deeper parts of your true nature when surrounded by acquaintances. It is interesting to ponder and then ask yourself why. What is it about walls and the spaces around you that change your expression of who you are? Your home is a very real reflection of who you are, and as a model of your interior universe, its walls are expressions of the demarcations within you and your various personality constructs. I always think of the Japanese people and their houses with paper-thin walls, showing that their barriers of privacy are almost more symbolic than material, and that their sense of privacy is inside their heads rather than in their walls. The vibrations of other lives must reach through the paper and be felt within their bones, and yet they maintain the illusion of a private existence. I would posit that those of you who have worked in one of those offices which has been partitioned like a rabbit warren by walls which only reach 2/3 of the way to the ceiling, and yet after a short time you are carrying on phone conversations as if everyone else cannot hear you. We are masters of creating our own illusory dimensions, with or without material constructs supporting us. Next, let us consider the presence of windows, and does your living room have a view? The prevailing aspect of your home's main room can tell us about your personality's primary inclination. Are you someone who is focused out or in? Windows and views convey the importance of the world to the individual, that they will find the answers out there rather than within themselves. The room which is contained and turned in suggests the home of someone who is more likely to search within for their succor. They might be someone who perhaps more often reads books and who explores the universe through their reading and their own thoughts on matters. Does your living room tell you that you primarily have a more extroverted or introverted orientation? Ask yourself, do you primarily seek the answers from without or within? What is it to be an extrovert? And what is it to be an introvert? The extrovert usually appears to be louder and often more visually arresting from the outside. He or she continually captures our attention. They seem to be more at home with the world's attention upon them. Our extrovert is often motivated to seize the consciousnesses of those around him or her by displaying themselves and putting on a show. Meanwhile, our introvert is firmly focused in and usually avoids the conscious attention of those around her or him. The introvert does not want to take center stage and have others peering in. Why? I would posit that our extrovert has encapsulated a version of themselves for public display, sort of a generalized personality construct with which he or she is happy to perform the public roles of the individual. Conversely, our introvert has not, or will not put together such a construct for this public role within their community. Working out who we are and dealing with who the world wants us to be are part and parcel of life, and the questions they pose are continually thrown up at us. Having a ready-made, inflatable version of your personality does not make it any more real than that of the often hidden and hypersensitive introvert who sometimes bottles up their myriad flavours within themselves. I think Julian Jaynes, author of The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, said it best when describing consciousness and what is inside our minds as thus. Oh, what a world of unseen visions and heard silences, this unsubstantial country of the mind. What ineffable essences, these touchless remembering and unshowable reveries, and the privacy of it all. A secret theatre of speechless monologue and prevenient counsel, an invisible mansion of all moods, musings, and mysteries, an infinite resort of disappointments and discoveries. A whole kingdom where each of us reigns reclusively alone, questioning what we will, commanding what we can. A hidden hermitage where we may study out the troubled book of what we have done and yet may do. An introcosm that is more myself than anything I can find in a mirror. This consciousness that is myself of selves, that is everything and yet nothing at all. What is it? Whether introvert or extrovert, we have these rich and fecund consciousnesses inside of us, and are all more than we often consider ourselves to be. Spend a moment now appreciating the amazingly complex, or the amazing complexity that resides within you, like a beautiful diamond with a multitude of gleaming facets, shining in and out like a cosmic solar star. The fact that we have multiple personalities within each of us is a blessing and a richness. We do not have to reduce everything to black or white. We can remain in a healthy state of contradiction and inconsistency. Don't waste your time trying to turn an orchestra into a single drum beat. We may be an introvert or extrovert for certain sections of our lives, especially as teenagers and young adults, times in our lives when change is hungrily upon us and we are not sure just who we really are. Schizophrenia and personality dysfunction conditions like this are most prevalent at these ages. It's funny, isn't it, that when we have passed through stages of life such as these, we become almost nonchalant about them. But in reality, these transitional developmental passages within our lives were and are often experienced as absolutely terrifying, and I suspect that many of us questioned and doubted our own sanity. Sanity, what is it really? It is like holding the reins of a large team of unruly horses or attempting to drive a car with a bank of multiple steering wheels all spinning in different directions. Once we have got through those early adult years having coalesced into a version of ourselves with which we are reasonably comfortable, we often know where the troublesome parts of ourselves live and consciously avoid them. We may remember the drug and alcohol-fueled escapes those sub-personalities or modern-day demons made and shamefully regret them. Or maybe more refined and subtle voices exerted their influences at this time through spiritual or religious inclinations, which took you into realms not readily visited. Love is probably the biggest catalyst for the coups and usurpations by sub-personalities with a bent for personal world domination. Who amongst us has not exhibited some strange and wonderful proclivities under the divine influence of Aphrodite and her hounds of love? Aphrodite was, of course, the goddess of love, according to the ancient Greeks, and was born of the foam of the sea and the mutilated genitals of Uranus, her father. So we have love emerging from the procreative cells of the father and the fertility and abundance of the sea. The Hellenistic worldview was a much more salty and real one, I think, than the later Christianized and spin-doctored view of chivalric love, which has come down to us through the centuries. Aphrodite was apparently very beautiful and was judged so by Paris in competition over the other great goddesses, Hera, wife-sister of Zeus, and Athena, goddess of justice. But like the other gods and goddesses, she could also be spiteful, deceitful, and jealous. She clearly represented the passion of love in all its guises, and as such Aphrodite was a force of nature in her effect upon the lives of mere mortals, and great conflagrations were unleashed through her. Love is like that, don't you think? It is like the uncorking of a bottle of champagne, a bursting forth of energy, and there are always bound to be a few spills and some things needing to be cleaned up afterwards. Aphrodite was, through her gift of Helen, the most beautiful woman in the world, who was unfortunately already married to someone else, to Paris, responsible for the Trojan War and its decade of killing and death. After an affair or relationship, especially a torrid and passionate one, we are often a little shamefaced. It is like we have let a genie out of the bottle or something, released a version of ourselves that the more sober and respectable, controlling personality does not readily recognize or perhaps refuses to acknowledge as part of you. Suddenly there is the wild, responsive subpersonality, who takes over when love is in the air, the one who can kick her heels up and the one that will climb every mountain to get to their beloved. We need these parts of ourselves to expand and take over in situations like that of the love affair, because without them, no love would be possible. Well, not the kind of love that you would bother writing home about. We are biologically hardwired for this so as to sustain the human species. Love is the fever for procreation. Life without love is sometimes said to be a life not worth living. We are often more alive at this time than at any other time, and the blood pumps through our veins, reminding us of what it means to be truly human. Passion is it perhaps why we incarnate, and what our souls crave is experience on this material plane. Perhaps D.H. Lawrence said it best in Women in Love. After a lapse of stillness, after the rivers of strange, dark, fluid richness had passed over her, flooding, carrying away her mind and flooding down her spine and down her knees, past her feet, a strange flood, sweeping away everything and leaving her an essential new being, she was left quite free. She was free in complete ease, her complete self. So she rose, stilly and blithe, smiling at him. He stood before her, glimmering, so awfully real, that her heart almost stopped beating. He stood there in his strange whole body, that had its marvellous fountains, like the bodies of the sons of God who were in the beginning. There were strange fountains of his body, more mysterious and potent than any she had imagined or known, more satisfying. Ah, finally, mystically, physically satisfying. She had thought there was no source deeper than the phallic source, and now, behold, from the smitten rock of the man's body, from the strange, marvellous flanks and thighs, deeper, further in mystery than the phallic source, came the floods of ineffable darkness and ineffable riches. There is always a price to pay for such intense feeling and experience. Perhaps too much, we say afterwards, as we nurse our wounded prides and hearts. But is it really too great a price? Many of us have a short experience of passion released and met by another, an intense courtship followed by the honeymoon, and then we live a life constrained by economic responsibilities that is noticeable by its absence of passion. We live in the memory of a fleeting love affair or engagement, and then often learn to live with the colour grey. We too readily put aside passion and let ourselves be convinced that other things are more important, that real life is somehow not about the magic of love. Real life is about paying the rent, the bills, and the mortgage, and we let it slip. Love gives us the slip, and we suddenly become like our parents or our perception of what we thought and saw of our parents' existence. They are our proto-models of all the models who came before us, and we will be the same for our children. Let us now talk of lighting. How well lit are you? Lighting. Is your living room well lit, or does it have natural light? Is your room a beacon of light, or is it a cozy, more shaded venue? Again, this speaks of how we present ourselves to the outside world. Do we approach life with all the lights on, or are we offering a quiet place for others to feel at home in? There are, of course, many degrees within this inner to outer spectrum, and it is useful to find which degrees you sit on. Becoming aware of these things often illuminates many of your nearest and dearest relationships. You can understand how your partner or family member fits into or with what you present. Clearly witnessing the dynamics around you can give you those, "Yes, now I understand why he or she did that," moments. We are sometimes ships at sea crashing through the waves on our way to who knows where and coping the best we can. So to get some insight into how we appear to those around us can be a real savior to our relationships. Relationship dynamics, who you are in relation to the other and what games do you play and how do you play them? What role do you play with your primary other? High status or low status? Giver or taker? Initiator or follower? It is entirely fascinating to see what role we find ourselves playing in these important relationships in our lives. Often the nature of our relationship can fluctuate over time or in regard to particular areas of life. For example, we may have met our current life partner at a stage of our life where we were in a submissive position, perhaps a student to their teacher or junior colleague to one more senior. We may, in these instances, find ourselves quite content for a period of time to exhibit a passive appreciation of their higher status within the relationship. But then things may evolve and the dynamic may alter. Men and women often find areas of responsibility based on their gender, with a traditional power base for the woman perhaps being domestic issues and things related to the home, and the male may exhibit some perceived level of expertise in relation to a physical or structural adeptness in the world. Of course, in the 21st century, many of these gender-based assumptions are now obsolete. But whatever the situation, it can be highly rewarding to bring some analysis to the inherent dynamics within your intimate relationships. Understanding that there ultimately needs to be fluidity within these dynamics is a precursor to the successful maintenance of these relationships in accordance with your growth and evolvement as a conscious human being. It is at this point that I think we will draw to a close the first part of House Therapy and Rediscovering the Secrets of You in a Non-Contemplative World. We have covered much, and I hope that you will join me when we start part two, which will soon be recorded and presented to you. I hope you enjoyed this. Our home is a lively reflection of our state of being, one that is constantly updated by our presence and the presence of our co-inhabitants, usually family, friends, and loved ones. Of course, homes change as we do. They reflect our stages of life. As children in a home, they are places to explore and to sometimes fear when the lights go out at night. They are also like the favourite clothes our mother and father might wear and are thus forever associated with them. When we are teenagers, they can be experienced as prisons of extreme boredom, never changing in their appearance or nature, always contaminated by the reactionary attitudes of our parents and places we might dream of escaping. Perhaps as young adults, in our first experience of living away from mum and dad, they are places of glorious freedom. With no one to nag you to clean up and any questionable hygiene issues and structural disrepairs are experienced positively as charming aspects of freshly found domestic bliss. Then as first-time parents, the home becomes a place requiring a tentative renovation to make safe, quiet, and nurturing for your beloved offspring. As a family home for our children, it is often a bustling, noisy place, shaking with all the life going on there. Then after the children have left the nest, quiet descends and the contrast can be mausoleum-like after years of frenetic activity. We then may move to something smaller, just for two and with lots of retiring quiet. Homes are, I think, three-dimensional mirrors, endlessly adjusting to our own evolving reflection throughout our lives. I do hope that you will join me for the next installment of House Therapy, Secrets About You. Take care and stay healthy. I would like to credit Kevin MacLeod for his backing track, Ever Mindful, which is available at